Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a discussion with IQ Al Rasooli on what caused 9/11, who was behind suicide bombings, why they did it. Is there a way to stop them from perpetrating more events that maim and mutilate innocent civilians? Because there is just one doctrine that is responsible for 99% of terrorist attacks today. It's the same one that perpetrated 9/11. So, IQ, based upon what you've said, both in word and deed, Islam was transformed from a ongoing argument of my God's going to torture you in hell for you saying things about me that I don't like, to when he arrives in Yathrib, today's Medina, the rhetoric becomes essentially a call to arms. It is a declaration of war on all humankind, and all of the acts of war, including plunder, are made lawful to the Muslims. Is that a reasonable summary of...
But it's not only including plunder. Slavery, ransoming,
right.
Torturing, and destroying
kidnapping.
The bodies of... mutilating the bodies of the dead.
Yes.
It was total war against people in every facet. Every diabolical
Muhammad
facet.
Muhammad mutilated bodies. Muhammad was engaged in kidnapping. Muhammad was engaged in torture. Muhammad was engaged in enslaving people. He was engaged in gang rape. All of these kinds of things. And based upon the basis of Islam, which the Quran says that Muhammad is the example to follow and Sharia law is based upon Muhammad's example, then all of these horrid behaviors became Islamic law.
Correct. You know, with all due respect to anybody listening who's an American, the fault is not with the Muslims. Boko Haram, the leader of Boko Haram, Abu Bakr, in public he says, I am following Muhammad. I'm following the Quran. The people who
Correct.
Killed the young man in England, a soldier, unarmed,
right.
they butchered
right.
him. They were quoting from the Quran. They were saying, this is our religion. This is our belief.
Right.
And our leaders say, no, they are not representing the truth. But they are representing the truth.
Well, they're representing...
You and I have been doing this for 10 years, representing
right.
the truth.
Yeah. What they are saying is exactly what Islam is. When Islam moved to Yathrib, today's Medina, it became nothing other than a declaration of war on all humankind, and Muhammad created this mechanism to reward his jihadists with plunder, with rape, and with whatever bloodthirst, bloodlust the people had. It was the most repulsive acts that humans have ever perpetrated on one another, and they became the living embodiment of the religion.
Correct. And they are declaring, we are
right.
only following our religious beliefs, and yet the Western leaders in our academia, in the clergy, and in politics, they say, no, they're not doing it. But who are we, no, not we, who are they, those people who are saying, not doing it,
right.
telling them, perpetrators who are claiming, they are declaring it. We are
right.
doing it according to our religion.
As a matter of fact, in the Quran, in the Medina verses, it actually declares in the ninth surah, the second to last handed down, that a Muslim who is not a jihadist, a Muslim who is not engaged in fighting for Allah's cause, ceases to be a Muslim. They become a hypocrite, and Muslims are told to go kill them.
Absolutely. Apostate of Islam.
Right.
If one is not a jihadi Muslim, he is not a Muslim. That is why you cannot talk about moderate Muslims or peaceful Muslims. They don't exist.
Right.
It is impossible.
No.
It's only in the imagination, the warped imagination of our
right.
leaders.
Yeah, the fact is the Quran defines good and bad Muslim. And it says that you are a good Muslim if you fight and kill for Allah, and you cease to be a Muslim if you do not fight and kill for Allah, which means it's impossible to be a peaceful, moderate Muslim. It's impossible. According to the Quran,
right.
the Quran is the only source of information that's considered credible to a Muslim. According to the Quran, according to their wannabe God, Allah, you cannot be a peaceful Muslim. You become a hypocrite.
Yada, and all the conversation you and I ever had, all the lectures we ever gave, we should blame not the Muslims. We should blame our leaders and only our leaders. The Muslims are telling the truth. The Muslims are not lying. They are saying this is our religion. We have to have jihad against all human beings until all human beings become part and parcel of Ummat al-Islam. It's not a hidden agenda.
So you're inferring here what I have said for a long time, that there is a way to stop them, rather than our leaders, rather than our leaders lying on their behalf and excusing the religion. All we need to do is to tell the truth about the religion, do what we did here, and explain how Islam came to be, how vicious it is, how foolish it is, how incompatible with civilization it is, and to expose and condemn the religion.
Correct.
That's what we need to do.
It's simple.
Yes.
It's not complicated. Nothing about Islam is complicated. Nothing.
You could win, since Islam was created with words, you could destroy it with words.
With words.
But you can never destroy it with bullets and bombs.
Correct. Absolutely correct.
And
that's why,
in fact,
Americans
views them
in Afghanistan,
right.
in Pakistan, in Iraq, in Libya, wherever America went to destroy Islam or to suppress Islam or to suppress. They can't. It's impossible.
In fact, Islam was conceived to thrive in the midst of war. So if you bring war to Muslims, that's when it thrives.
Absolutely.
That's
when
it grows. Right.
Al-Mawt bi Sabilillah means there will be shuhada, means they are martyrs, and they'll end up with the 72 virgins in Muhammad's whorehouse version of paradise.
So that would mean that if you wanted to cause Islam to flourish, if you wanted to increase Islamic acts of terrorism, then you would go and fight Islam with conventional weapons. And if you wanted to cause Islam to flounder and to no longer perpetrate acts of terrorism, you would engage only with words.
Correct. Again, by the way, if you want me to continue with you for the next 10, 15 minutes, I can do so.
Yeah. Okay, wonderful. In this regard, is it not true that in an Islamic country, words that we are speaking now are outlawed, but weapons are not?
Of course, they are outlawed. Because it's contrary to what they try to persuade other human beings. It's called taqiyya, Islamic subterfuge, sanctioned Islamic subterfuge. Taqiyya. They lie to you. They lie to us.
So in our countries, their religion commands them to deceive infidels, to make infidels easier prey. But in their countries, you can't tell the truth about Muhammad. If this conversation we were having, even though it's 100% accurate, 100% confirmed in the Quran and Hadith, we would be killed for having this conversation in any Islamic country.
We would be slaughtered, not killed. Slaughtered. By the way, Bukhari Hadith 5780, we must deal with our enemies with smiles on our faces and curses in our hearts. This is Hadith.
Yes.
And
there's
only one. Right. Thousands of them are the same.
Correct. In fact, Muhammad said, I've become victorious with terror.
With terror, yes.
Yeah. Now,
nothing is hidden. This is the fantastic thing about Islam. It is all there. All the rot is there. All the sickness is there. All the disease is there. It's a curse upon humanity.
When the 19 Muslims that were suicide bombers, which is Islam's signature act today, flew those planes into our buildings and killed 3,000 people that day, did they not confess to the crime screaming Allahu Akbar?
Absolutely. The minute they scream Allahu Akbar, it is a confession before death. Absolutely.
Why don't you tell us the first time that Allahu Akbar was shouted in Islam?
When they were attacking the Khaybar, Jewish agricultural community. They were shouting
Jewish
Allahu
farming
Akbar.
Community.
Yes.
All right, and this Jewish farming community, when they first shouted Allahu Akbar, the Jewish community, did it have a military?
None. In fact, they were caught with their pants down. They had their spades in one hand and baskets in another. They had no arms.
Right. They were going out to the fields. And Muhammad showed up with his jihadists, his mujahideen, armed to the hilt, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the first thing they wanted to do was to impress upon these Jews that their God was older, bigger, and greater than was the God of the Jews, Yahweh. So that's when they shouted, Allahu Akbar.
Yeah.
Right. So by shouting that, what it means is that Allah is absolutely not the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. He is not the God of the Yahweh, because the Islamic God, Allah, is older, bigger, and greater than Yahweh.
Correct.
So they can't be the same.
They are not the same. Yeah. They're not the same. The first revelation, Al-Alaq, chapter 1, chapter 96, verse 1, proves the creation of humanity is wrong. The second item is when he said he flew to the Temple of Solomon and he prayed at the Temple of Solomon ahead of all the other prophets. Another lie. Both of them are enormous lies. With these two alone, I don't need any more.
Well, nobody, how about the fact that the sun and the moon are in chariots racing each other across the sky, and the sun goes to bed each night in a muddy spring, according to the Quran?
Correct. And one of the miracles that he was supposed to have done in Hadith, the moon was split in half. One half landed in one mountain, the other half landed in another mountain, and then came back again.
Yeah, Muhammad put it back together again.
It's self-destructive.
In fact, Muhammad's whole presentation of history in the Quran is erroneous. I mean, not only isn't there a single prophecy to infer divine inspiration, he couldn't even get history right.
He didn't get anything right. Everything he copied from the Bible, whether the Hebrew or Christian Bible, was wrong. Every single item.
Actually, he didn't copy anything actually, he didn't copy anything from the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. He plagiarized the Talmud. He bought Talmud recitals from the rabbis in Yathrib, and then twisted them to serve his agenda. And so, there's enormous swaths of the Quran that are nothing but plagiarized versions of the Talmud.
Correct.
Yeah, it's the whole thing is such a pile of lies. It is so wretched. And yet, the last 24 surahs of the Quran, those revealed in the beginning of the Islamic era, after the pledge of Aqaba to wage war against all humankind, are nothing other than a terrorist manifesto. That is all that there is to Islam. So why should we be surprised that they perpetrated 9/11. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a discussion with IQ Al-Rasuli, the world's foremost expert on Islam. IQ, when you do what you have done, and you take the time to explain the basis of Islam, it would seem that any informed, rational individual, any moral individual, would oppose the religion because of the terrorism it continues to inspire. But why is the world just so timid about not holding a religion accountable for the most heinous behavior in human history?
Denial. That's the only thing I can think of. I can't, honestly, after 30 years, I still haven't figured it out. Why people...
Let me pose the question a little different. Yeah, let me put it a different way. We didn't just discuss the violent nature of Islam. We went right back to the beginning of Islam and discussed the stupidity of it, the obvious errors in it. And the reason I wanted you to bring out the idiocy of Islam is my hope is that when people know just how stupid this is, how unreliable it is, how obviously false it is, then rather than feeling badly about exposing and condemning a religion that perpetrates 99.9% of the world's terrorist events, that they would feel good about it, that they know that by exposing and condemning the religion, they're not only thwarting terrorism, but they have the potential to save Muslims from, you know, a horrible fate because their religion is so obviously false.
I agree with you, but I can't figure it out. You might have a solution.
In the Islamic world, there's a reason that they do not outlaw weapons, but they outlaw words. Because in the Islamic world, they know for certain that if somebody speaks truthfully, quoting the Islamic scriptures to expose and condemn Islam, Islam cannot survive it. When Muhammad is exposed as a rapist, pedophile, terrorist, mass murderer, sadistic man that he actually was, Islam cannot survive that. When Allah's lies are exposed, Islam cannot survive the truth. And so they outlaw free speech in every Islamic country. In the West, we don't outlaw free speech unless we created this new genre of hate speech, where if you say something that a religious group feels is offensive, in many countries now, you're not allowed to even to say that. So you can't even speak the truth.
Tell me why.
Well, you know, I have come to the conclusion that those who wish to move the world towards war, those who wish to become more powerful, realize that Islamic terrorism is the ultimate means to what they want to do. You can deprive people of their property, of their freedom, of their will by positioning a nebulous threat that the world all has to make sacrifices for to thwart. And Islamic terrorism, if it's not called Islamic terrorism but just simply terrorism, becomes that threat, an imaginary foe. And you can fleece people, control them, because they will give up enormous rights to be protected from this imaginary foe. Now, the foe is real. The foe happens to be Islam, but not the way it's presented. And so it empowers people. It justifies America spending $1 billion on its defense, or excuse me, $1 trillion on its defense. It justifies America restraining people's rights and overtaxing them. And so it's a tool.
Okay, but that tool is leading to Armageddon. Not
right.
Only in America, not only among the Muslims, mm-hmm. It's a worldwide catastrophe.
Yeah, I had the opportunity not too long ago to translate Isaiah 17 and 18, Yahshua 17 and 18. God is very clear about how the Syrian war ends and the jihadists that flow out of it and the consequence of it and how it leads to world war. He tells you every step of the way exactly what's going to happen. We know exactly where this leads. And yet,
we are the prophets
continue.
Of doom.
We are.
We are the prophets of doom.
We're telling people what they're going to. We are literally telling them that the sky of Islam is falling, and that if you don't stand up and show some courage, that it's going to destroy everything you hold dear.
Correct.
And we prove it. And Yahweh himself predicted it. And yet, not one in 1,000 people listen, because it's not what their politicians are telling them. It's not what their religious cleric is telling them. It's not what their professor is telling them.
Correct.
They're all lying.
See you next week.
They're all lying. It's my pleasure to have you, IQ. Thank you for spending this extra time and exposing what happened on 9/11. It is essential that Americans understand that 9/11 was not a terrorist act. It was an expression of Islam, not a corruption of Islam. It was Islam exactly as it was lived and conceived by Muhammad. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. The frustrations you heard in IQ Al-Rasuli's voice towards the end of that segment is heartfelt. It's genuine. And the reason he's concerned is that the evidence is so clear. It's undeniable and it's ubiquitous. The absolute proof that Muhammad was a ruthless and savage terrorist, first and foremost, he was a slave trader, a kidnapper, a mass murderer, a thief, a rapist, a pedophile, is undeniable. The only sources that date to within 200 years of Muhammad's life and death not only portray him that way, that's the only way they portray him. There are no redeeming qualities. It is so clear that the Quran is just a pile of lies, that it's among the worst books ever written, that there's nothing in it that's true, that it is bewildering, that with information this clear, this obvious, this easy to verify, that the vast preponderance of people cling to myths. But it really is no different than the myths of Judaism and Christianity. They're not as easy to prove as untrue, but nonetheless are also false. We have Glenn, who has been with us for a long time, has held on for a long time. I'm sorry to have you for that long a time. I had a mission today. I really wanted to go through the birth of Islam all the way to the consequence of Islam, 9/11, now that that museum in New York is being celebrated. But it's my pleasure to have you on, Glenn.
Thank you. Early on in the first hour with IQ, you were talking about transportation in the region, you know, ships versus caravans and such. Now, Muhammad had made a halting effort to get his flying-ass airborne courier service going, but since he was illiterate, he had trouble working up a workable invoicing system, and his financials flubbed in the first year. The gauntlet was later taken up by Santa Claus, who had a larger stable of flying mammalian quadrupeds. That was colossal success, and the rest is, as they say, history.
it's true that Muhammad did say that his flying quadruped was a wild ass. It was a winged wild ass. As a matter of fact, the Dome of the Rock, which is the is that great pimple on the Temple Mount, the Dome of the Rock is over the hoofy print where Muhammad's winged ass leapt from the Temple Mount to heaven, which tells you that the only way you can get to heaven happens to be from what occurred on the Temple Mount, even by Islam's own admission. But it's the Dome of the Hoofy Print, and it was a wild ass. And I can tell you that the tales of flying reindeer and Santa Claus are actually more credible than is the story that Muhammad wove in his Quran.
Yeah, it's a bit crazy, but I wanted to actually talk about the Ukraine just briefly today.
Okay. By the way, did you compile that just all in your head? That is clever. You could make a living doing that. It was before we move on. I want to tell you that I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that immensely. Okay,
well,
let's move on to the Ukraine.
Okay, very good. I've been watching what's been going on in Ukraine and waiting to see where it's going to go. We're listed a bit.
Where is it going to go now?
Yeah, in the past few weeks, I was thinking that if ethnic Russians started dying in Ukraine, at a certain rate, and it would reach a critical mass point, at which point he might actually bring in tactical air support against APCs and tanks and stuff like
right.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But that did not happen, and the rate at which people are dying isn't.
Right.
If I were him, I would want, I've already got my big prize, Crimea. I've got the industry, I've got my naval bases, I've got the most productive area. I've got to answer to the sentiments of the ethnic
There is one additional prize. There's one additional prize. And he's not going to get that. He knows he's not going to get that. That's why he said, I'm not going to send any more oil through it unless the Ukraine pays in advance in cash, because they welch on their deals. They're $2 billion in arrears right now. No, there's one prize in the eastern part of the country, and that is there's an oligarch there. In fact, he rose his ugly head yesterday. Yeah, he owns this oligarch owns has 300,000 employees. He's worth about $11 billion. He has his own private army. And his interests are in his business. And if Putin takes it, or if he is seen as aiding Putin, then no one will buy his products. He sells his products, steel and others, in some 100 countries.
You're stealing my thunder, but yeah.
Yeah. So that is a really interesting maneuver, particularly because in the Ukraine, he is essentially a mob boss. In the Ukraine, right. As a mob boss, he's been able to flourish. I mean, he literally became the meanest of the mob bosses when the Ukraine was formed 20 years ago. In Russia, he would only be able to remain an oligarch if he played nice with Putin. But in Ukraine, he can endear himself as now the power of the Ukraine by siding with Kiev and continue his business interests.
Well, he's way ahead in the polls. If you're talking about Peter Poroshenko, I assume. The billionaire oligarch who's running for the presidency.
The guy out of the East. I clipped an article on him today. He's been camera side, never appeared on camera until yesterday. And yesterday he gave a speech that basically said that he wanted Ukraine to stay as as one nation, as opposed to being split in two. And his reasons for saying so.
He's a Russian oligarch.
He's a Russian oligarch in the Ukraine, has 300,000 employees, has his own, his basic setup is no different than him being a lord in feudal Europe.
Right.
But his situation is such that he knows that if he is overtly seen as siding with Putin, then his customers are going to dry up because of U.S. sanctions. And if he is seen being opposed to Putin, then he's probably a dead man. And is because there's too many ethnic Russians that want to integrate with Russia. But it creates a very interesting situation, particularly because the Ukraine itself is broke, and the Ukraine's not going to get any gas beyond June because Russia's saying, unless you pay us in cash in advance, you already owe us $2 billion. We're not sending any more gas to Ukraine. It just dries up and shrivels.
Yeah.
And the West is not allowing the billions of dollars that we're providing to the Ukraine to pay for the Russian gas bill. So we're creating a scenario here that's about to explode.
Right, exactly. You're kind of Bill Beagling me, Yannick.
Okay.
You know Bill Beagle?
Yeah.
You're Bill Beagling me. But that's great. I can build on that foundation for a second, but I wanted to lay this out for a minute. So we definitely have the oligarchs in the equation, which, as you said, and everything you just said, helps to illustrate the behind the scenes tensions with which Putin has to be wrestling.
Right.
If Putin already having Crimea, now the overt social pressure of having to go in militarily to rescue ethnic Russians being killed in large numbers would be tough, but he managed to pull the military back. If he can get away with not having to do that, and the question was, why did he encourage them not to have the referendum they recently held, but went ahead and held anyway, where they want increased autonomy for area regions like the Nets and Slavyansk and some of those other cities? It turned out to be relatively little harm in those referenda. They were aware of their desire for greater autonomy. Okay, that has helped. The way he's playing
They don't want autonomy. That's not what those referendums were about. They were not about greater autonomy. They were for complete independence. They were complete independence.
Right. One of their original statements was to that effect.
Right.
Obviously, they wanted to affiliate with Russia. Now, if so you have that aspect of things. Now, if they're not being killed and they have this May 25th, Obama actually made a reference to, duly elected government. So, the present government in Ukraine is not duly elected. They're a coup junta. But if the May 25th elections go through, then they will have a government that can claim to be duly elected. So we have to go in before then, for the election. Once the election occurs, it's binding, and there's a major NATO boots-on-the-ground drill plan for Ukraine. So if they can get the election through, get those, get a pawn in office, mm-hmm. and then get a NATO boots on the ground in the country, then all opportunities for Putin to act militarily are completely gone by that time. So it seems to me like at this point, and when you look at the cast of characters coming up, I still maintain that Yulia Tymoshenko, who was one who fomented all these radical right Nazi types and everything, mm-hmm. I think she's much more of a player even at this time. Although mm-hmm. although Alex Turchynov is president, Arseniy Yatsenko is the prime minister. Now, I think some of these people will be held in, but it looks like a billionaire oligarch, Peter Poroshenko, is the one who's favored for the president title.
Right,
he's a
Russian oligarch. It all comes back down to who is going to be responsible for the enormous drain of capital and military might to keep this pretend country afloat. And right. if the United States continues to play it as it's being played, then the burden to keep Ukraine afloat, which will be about $20 billion a year in monetary support and about $20 billion a year in military support, will be borne by the United States. And it will not succeed.
Exactly.
And it will not succeed. It'll just be a burden. And if I'm reading the cards correctly, I don't think Putin wants to invade the eastern part of the country. I don't think he thinks it's worth it. I'm quite convinced that.
He's brilliant.
Yeah, I don't think he thinks it's worth it. And I think what he has done is now shackled those who have heckled him with a $40 billion annual burden.
Yep. And a lot of the trade will still go their way, too.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. The upshot of your presentation there, Glenn, is that you think that the United States is going to get what it wants, but that what it wants is going to be extraordinarily costly, that it's going to get the Ukraine. And that it, to do so, is going to have to promise military support and financial support collectively that are going to run in the range of $50 to $60 billion a year with no chance of long-term viability.
Well, Putin's going to be the big winner in the long run because he gets us to take on another international welfare client.
Yes.
He gets to sell gas to Ukraine, across Ukraine, and even if they're deadbeats, he gets to sell to Germany through them, everything like that.
Yeah.
He gets to sell to Western Europe through that pipeline.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's got revenue source. His sanctions get lifted on his oligarch buddies.
Yep.
The people killed are numbered only in the hundreds. The thousands or tens of thousands.
Right.
He gets Crimea, and we get a welfare state to support. It's like he totally checkmate. It's total checkmate.
It's my impression of the way that it's playing out as well.
And it looks like they're going to put Poroshenko in as president. You'll have Tymoshenko doing the mafia stuff in the background. Yatsenyuk mm-hmm. up front as the front man, and then and Turchynov is going to be out because he's the Baptist pastor guy who's not going to fit in culturally.
Yeah, the only problem with all of that is that there is such hatred now between the ethnic Russians and those playing government in Kiev in the northwest of the country that it's still highly likely to break into civil war. Now, that being the case, the equation for the cost for the United States goes up exponentially because the Ukraine, having spent $5 billion a year on their military, is already shown that it's wholly and completely ineffective in internal policing. As a matter of fact, studies now show that 80% of the money spent on the Ukraine's military is scammed by the oligarchs. Which means that now the United States, rather than spending $50 or $60 billion a year to claim its prize, is going to have to spend maybe upwards of $100 billion a year to claim this great prize.
Well, I think it's in the interest of both parties, both Putin and the West, if they can quell, you know, short of doing a Pakistan thing, like I said the other day, where you move to create a line
right.
and say, okay, Russians, south of this, if you're not going to do that, I'm not sure that these are people who've lived together in peace until this trouble was fomented. I've heard a story told by a woman whose father was killed. You know, they had gotten along with the Ukrainians all along, and then one day after this was fomented, they shot her father out on the porch and that sort of thing. But they had it. But if they can find some way of making, like, peace overtures and providing semblance of prosperity, they might be able to quell
this. Not going to happen. Just not going to happen.
Yeah.
The Ukrainians and the Russians are both way too prone to rage. And so it's just not going to happen. So it's going to erupt and continue to be riotous and volatile and deadly. And it's just now that they become the brat of America. I didn't want them in the first place, but that is really the way this is playing out. And I think that Putin's going to walks away with everything he wants, and just another nail in America's bankrupt coffin.
Right. That the internal strife is a huge problem, because it seems like Putin has resorted to proxy war strategy by providing the rockets that took down those Ukrainian helicopters.
The business deals between Russia and other countries began to bite. Most every country has capitulated. France capitulated with helicopters that are jointly made with GE for the Russian fleet. So France is out of that deal. Germany backed out of the deal because they do too much business with Russia. Canada just announced today that they're not backing the U.S. boycotts of Russia either. So the attempt to boycott Russia backfired. It didn't work.
Well, if they can't cobble together, then Putin's back to square one, where that he's got large numbers of ethnic Russians dying, crying for help, and even, you know, then it could almost be a scenario where he would just go and wipe the slate, you know, boot the government and take it over. But I don't know. It doesn't seem like that's going to happen.
I don't think that's what Putin wants. I think the West misread his intentions, and I do think that the West is going to get exactly what it wanted, and that the consequence of that is going to be financially disastrous for America. Sometimes when you get what you want, you find out that you don't want what you get.